Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Pope Benedict discuss the global economic crisis. Hear more details of that meeting from Britain's ambassador to the Holy See. And nearly 20 years on, we look back at the legacy of the six Jesuits murdered during El Salvador's civil war. Here in the Vatican on Thursday, Pope Benedict received in audience the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who's also meeting with Italian leaders here ahead of the G8 and G20 summits later this year. The Prime Minister spent about an hour and a half altogether in the Vatican meeting with Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone and other officials before introducing his wife and two young children to Pope Benedict XVI. A short statement from the Vatican said that in their private meeting the two leaders discussed the present global economic crisis and the duty to pursue initiatives that benefit the least developed countries. They also talked about a renewed commitment on the part of the international community in settling ongoing conflicts, particularly in the Middle East. But to find out more about the meeting, I went off to a short press briefing and spoke with Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell, who accompanied the Prime Minister and his family to this papal audience. Ambassador Francis Campbell, you've been accompanying the Prime Minister on this important visit here to the Vatican, meeting with Pope Benedict, I understand, quite a lot longer than expected.
Yes, the meeting did continue for quite a time, and it was, Prime Minister told me, a meeting of substance. He enjoyed very much his conversation with the Holy Father. It was certainly went on beyond 35 minutes. And then a substantial meeting also with Cardinal Bertone, Cardinal Secretary of State, and also the Archbishop Mamberti, the Foreign Minister.
I understand that during the conversations, the possibility of a papal visit to the United Kingdom came about.
Well, the Prime Minister has just spoken to a pool of journalists here, and he said that in his one-to-one conversation with the Holy Father, they talked about a possible visit to the United Kingdom. And again, when I was present with the encounter with the Cardinal Secretary of State, the Prime Minister again extended an invitation to the Pope to visit the United Kingdom. And the Vatican certainly showed great appreciation for the fact that the Prime Minister has extended an invitation for the Pope to come and visit the country.
Can we have any kind of speculation as to when such a visit might take place?
I think, Philip, that's a question more for the Vatican than for us. I think we certainly have left the Vatican no doubt that the Pope would be welcome to visit the UK. And there was some parallel conversations about what occasion might arise in which the Holy Father could visit. And there was some suggestion that perhaps the possible beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman might be a suitable occasion in which the Pope might consider a visit to the country. And I know Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor has made representations to the Vatican along those lines.
The Prime Minister and the Pope also had quite a lot of discussion around the current global financial crisis and the importance of remembering the poorest in the developing world during this crisis, didn't they?
That is correct. They talked in great detail in both meetings with the Secretary of State and with the Pope. They talked a lot about the economic crisis and the potential impact this will have on the developing world, particularly in Africa. The Prime Minister spoke at length about his plans for the London summit of the G20 at the beginning of April. And the desire to have a dialogue with faith groups and with the Holy See in the build-up to that conference and to that summit, and really that the developing world cannot be forgotten about in this equation, that they too are having are feeling the effects of the economic crisis. And there was a substantial amount of dialogue with the Holy See on that, and they see this as a shared objective with the United Kingdom to ensure that countries do not renege on the promises they have made to the developing world, but continue to try to reach and achieve the Millennium Development Goals by 2015.
The gift that the Prime Minister brought for Pope Benedict also reflected that commitment to Africa, didn't it? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, very much so. The gift that the Prime Minister bought was a very personal one. And it linked back, it was a thank you from a mother and child in Ethiopia to the Pope for his contribution in buying the first immunisation bond in November 2006. And that bond has raised so far $1.6 billion for immunisation. And the Pope was the very first person to buy the bond. And he was following on from what his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, had done, because Pope John Paul II was one of the first, if not the first, international leader to give his backing to something called the International Finance Facility. In a speech here in May 2004, the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, now Prime Minister, first came to the Vatican and delivered that speech.
A meeting organised by the Justice and Peace Council, wasn't it?
That is correct. It was organised by Cardinal Martino, and Cardinal Martino has been at the forefront of this relationship between the United Kingdom and the Holy See on international development. And in November 06, Pope Benedict XVI sent Cardinal Martino to London to represent him and to receive the first bond. And because the Pope came on board in November 2006, then all the other religious leaders representing the main denominations, they stepped forward to purchase bonds, subsequent bonds, and really added to the great success of the initiative.
So a very practical sign of the symbolic commitment as well to this area of the world.
You couldn't get a more practical or tangible expression of the relationship between the UK and the Holy See on international development than the immunisation bond. The Prime Minister in his comments to the press has just said, look, it will lead to 500 million more children being immunised, and it will save 5 million children. It will save 5 million lives of infants who would die had they not received the immunisation. So there are few more practical expressions of the relationship between the UK and the Holy See than the immunisation bond. And that's why it was really a very fitting gift to remind the Holy Father of the contribution he has made to this project.
Finally, I understand there was also some discussion of the commitment to the Middle East in relation also to Pope Benedict's upcoming visit to Israel and Palestine.
Yes, there was a discussion between the Pope and the Prime Minister, and also with the Cardinal Secretary of State, about prospects for peace in the Middle East. The Prime Minister was very interested in the fact that the Pope's forthcoming travel plans included Angola, Cameroon and the Middle East. And there was really a substantial discussion on that.
And my thanks there to Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell, who accompanied Prime Minister Gordon Brown to an audience in the Vatican on Thursday morning. Crosses and Resurrections in El Salvador Today was the title of a lecture given in locations around the UK this week by a Jesuit theology professor at the University of Central America in El Salvador. Back in November 1989, Father Dean Brackley was living in his native New York and working on social justice programs in the notorious South Bronx when he heard the news that would change his life forever.
I received a phone call on the morning of November 16th, the morning of the killings, at 9:30 in the morning, 8:30 El Salvador time. I received a phone call informing me of these deaths.
Six of his brother Jesuits at the university in El Salvador had been massacred, along with their housekeeper and her daughter, in yet another attack on the church in the war-torn Central American nation. Nearly a decade earlier, Archbishop Oscar Romero had been gunned down while saying Mass, many believed because of his refusal to stay silent in the face of atrocities by government-backed death squads, and at least a dozen other priests had been killed as they worked for justice amongst the poor and persecuted. The government initially blamed the Jesuits' murders on guerrillas from the left-wing FMLN that had been fighting a civil war since the late 1970s. But a UN Truth Commission later found that the right-wing government had ordered the killings and that over half of the military officers involved in the massacre had been trained at the US Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. Though El Salvador's National Assembly gave amnesties to those convicted of the killings, the unfolding truths about state-sponsored violence did lead to new efforts for a peace agreement, which was finally signed in January 1992. But in the immediate aftermath of the murders, several other Jesuit priests immediately offered to go down to the Central American University to take over where their slain brothers had left off, calling for peace, for justice, and for reconciliation in the war-ravaged nation.
Very quickly, I realized the power of these martyrdoms to change the course of events in El Salvador.
One of them was Father Dean Brackley, who talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about the reasons for his decision and the legacy left by these Jesuit martyrs to the church in El Salvador.
I began to reflect that the Jesuits in Central America had comparatively few people trained for university work, and that it would be necessary for them to reach outside of Central America in order to fill the void or address the absence of these six Jesuits who had been important in the administration of the university. And I began to ask myself who they would be wise if they got someone from the United States, given U.S. involvement in the war and for other reasons. It would have to be someone in good health, someone who spoke Spanish, who had some awareness of Central America and of work among the poor. And then I began to realize that I fulfilled most of those, all of those requirements. And so I had the sense of, well, if you'll forgive me a baseball metaphor, of a pitch, a perfect pitch coming toward me, and one that I could let pass, but would probably regret not swinging at. In addition, decisions to accompany the poor had always seemed to work out for the better in my own past history. And so I wrote a letter requesting to join the faculty at the UCA and explaining that I had just begun to teach theology at Fordham. And to my surprise, in February, 2 months after the killings, I was asked to join the Jesuits in Central America.
Can I ask you, Father Dean, what prepares you for a departure like this? Was there anything in your life previously that prepared you for what you were going to?
Yes. In fact, as I look back, it seems that almost everything prepared me for this. First of all, I was living and working in the South Bronx, and I was growing accustomed to a level of insecurity, a level of stress, you might say, and the presence of violence. And this served me very well, to be going to an area that was at war and where I would be subjected not to physical danger, but certainly to stress and to the presence of violence in the country. Secondly, I had been working in Latino communities of immigrants, and mostly in New York City, for many years, and so had some command of Spanish. I had just begun to teach theology, and I had a degree in theology, a graduate degree in theology. I had actually studied with Ignacio Martín Baró for 4 years of graduate school, and had also been closely following events in Central America and had visited on two occasions during the war. As I look back, this academic preparation, my pastoral work, the engagement with other cultures, a certain level of frustration, learning patience, an important virtue in a place like Central America, all of this had providentially prepared me for going to Central America, even though what I found when I arrived was very different from the image that I had created in my head.
What were the most difficult challenges for you in those months following the murders, do you think?
Well, it may sound mundane. I found it difficult to find resources that would be useful for teaching. I mean, we had to do very practical things like teach these classes. In some ways, adjusting to the culture was far more difficult and challenging than I suspected. I was accustomed to the Caribbean culture, African-American culture, Mexican culture, and I found Central American culture in the middle of a war to be more formal, and people at oftentimes closed within their circles of trust in wartime. So breaking into that culture was more of a challenge than I had thought. At the same time, I was being asked to do and assume responsibilities to which I really felt inadequate. One of the most striking memories of me is just how inept I felt being asked to teach these classes, to run undergraduate theology programs, to be pastor of a rural parish, to have responsibility for Jesuit seminarians in a house of formation. All of this seemed really beyond my abilities.
20 years ago after these deaths, what do you think is the most important legacy of these Jesuit martyrs?
All of us are struck, I think, by the power of the witness of martyrs, present-day martyrs who have died for the values of the kingdom, died for the poor, for a commitment to social justice, peace, that is informed by their faith. They continue to give life. I'm struck by how, I guess, I have learned over the years to see these crucifixions and resurrections as the deepest meaning of our life. And this credible love, having a power that extends 20 years beyond the time of their deaths. We see this in the powerful witness and the image of Archbishop Romero, a real model bishop for the church. We see this in the Jesuits and the two women who died at the UCA, who inspire us, I think, to question and ask ourselves, what should Catholic education be today? What should education inspired by Christian values look like in our divided and broken world? The many other church workers who gave their lives in El Salvador and elsewhere continue to be remembered and inspire a youth that is much more questioning, much more open to novelty, much more suspicious of hypocrisy. Our young people continue to respond to the credible love of our martyrs. We have a vigil each year at our university. I think this year we counted about 11,000 people present, the majority of them young people who are inspired by this model of Christian service.
Now, your order was involved in efforts to bring the people behind these murders to justice. Do you think the latest decision to investigate the 14 military officers may help to bring the case to a close?
We do. We continue to pursue the truth in this issue, although we are not, Jesuits in Central America are not directly involved in this particular case that has opened in Spain. We're more interested in helping to overcome impunity within the Salvadoran judicial system. Nevertheless, we believe this will help to bring truth, help to bring justice, all in the service of reconciliation, which has not taken place in El Salvador. We continue to live with that legacy. The wounds are still open. Sometimes we're accused of living in the past, of wanting to open old wounds. And we encourage people to talk to the victims, talk to the relatives of those who were murdered during the war, and to come to understand that for them, the wounds have never really healed. And so it's necessary that the truth come out. And when we talk about justice, we're talking about formal judgment on the part of the Salvadoran government, state, judicial system. We're not talking about revenge. We will be the first ones to petition a legal indult for those who were responsible for ordering the killings of the Jesuits and the two women. But we believe it's necessary on behalf of all the victims to pursue this case in order to overcome the impunity which continues to lacerate the social life of El Salvador.
We must remember that there were some 75,000 deaths plus, you know, so many other disappearances and human rights abuses during El Salvador's civil war. How important is it to seek justice and compensation for their families?
We agree with the Organization of American States and its Human Rights Commission that El Salvador must bring its legislation in line with its international obligations under human rights treaties. The government pardoned itself very quickly at the end of the war. This is not the way to bring about reconciliation within the country. We continue to insist on the process of truth, justice, and in the case of the victims, at least a symbolic indemnization on the part of the state. The increasing the level of education in the country where people have only received 6 years of education on average, to, in the name of the victims, increase spending on on healthcare services, where in a country where many people die for lack of those services, to provide a pension for peasant workers who have no help in their ages of retirement. These would be the types of symbolic forms of reparation that would help to heal wounds.
El Salvador today, is it a very different place today? And what would be the main issues that would concern you in the country today?
In Salvador, El Salvador is in many ways certainly different. Half of our population is 21 years or younger in the region of Central America. So it would be about that in El Salvador. This is the first generation that is majority urban. The first generation raised universally in front of the television set. They might not eat three times a day, but they've got some uncle in the United States that sends money. They may know more about Britney Spears or some popular entertainer than they do about Archbishop Romero. They're the first generation that does not see themselves as fated to live as their parents did. And this presents an enormous challenge, a pastoral challenge to the church. Church cannot presume that these people belong to them. We have to give a credible testimony, a credible evangelization, support to these young people. So that's a new reality. And many of these people will be migrating to the city, migrating in fact to the United States. The country remains a very violent place, but the violence is less political today than it is delinquency of desperate young people who seek in gangs what the society, the belonging, sense of belonging that is denied them in their mostly urban societies. This is one of the most dangerous people for young people to live in the world. The right-wing party, founded by really Robert Reto de Abuison, an organizer of death squads, has been in power now for 20 years. This is a legacy of control by elites that goes back to the Spanish conquest. We have an election next month that represents a growing opposition toward that type of privileged rule by the privileged. And it's very possible, as a result of this change in the post-war period, that the former guerrilla party candidate for presidency will win the election next March. This will bring about certainly a change in the political climate. People are generally free today to speak out, to criticize, to organize activities that would have gotten them killed during the 70s and 80s. This is certainly very important. On the other hand, the economic situation has not improved dramatically. And as a result, the country is expelling hundreds of people a day who make their way north, mostly to the United States. My estimate is that the majority of Salvadorans will be living in the United States within 25 years. The traditional safety valve for our historic inequality had been to die before your time. In the 20th century, there was a safety valve of hope for social change, modernization. Today, no one expects our economic situation to improve anytime soon, even with a change of government. And so one of the major changes is the continual hemorrhaging of people from the country making their way north to the United States.
How important is faith for young people in El Salvador today?
One of the great resources and signs of hope for us is the religious sensitivity and sensibility of our people. In our university polling, almost everyone in El Salvador says they believe in God. And 87% of the population says that religion is important in the life of the country. Sometimes I question just what God people believe in, but everyone says they believe in God. Today, 55% of the population identifies itself as Catholic, which is low. During the political and military crisis years, there was a strong growth of Pentecostal Protestantism in the country. Today, just under 30% of the population identifies itself as evangelico or Protestant. And yet the church, the Catholic Church, remains a very vital and important force in people's lives. Our challenge, as I said, is to communicate a credible message, a credible good news to a poor population, that our gospel be good news to the poor. And the martyrs that we've discussed at the beginning are a credible witness to that gospel. If we're honest, we have to understand that in a polarized and divided society that is also religious, polarization affects the church. Not everyone identifies with the legacy of Archbishop Romero. Not everyone sees the mission of the church as necessarily prophetic. Not everyone appreciates the social dimension of the message and ministry of the church. And yet there is a critical mass of people in the country that have identified with that message that is sealed in the blood of our martyrs. That's the greatest hope, the greatest sign of hope that we have in the country. And it's a legacy that has to continue to leaven the wider church. In a way, it's our most important export as well from El Salvador to the universal church.
How hard is it for the church there to maintain its prophetic role of the Civil War years?
There are many challenges. There are certainly many conservative forces within the church that I think with a biased view of that prophetic liberating message fall into sacramentalism, fall into more infantile and authoritarian forms of church life. Certainly we have that. That's certainly a threat. The secularist culture of El Salvador is a threat. There's a great deal of cynicism when people are, thanks to the media and new sources of information, constantly made aware of the corruption of public officials and of bad examples even within the church. So more than ever, there is a pressing need for credible witness and sound teaching, in order to attract people who don't see the Catholic Church as something automatic anymore in Central America.
Finally, Father Dean, I just wanted to ask you, looking back on your life, did you ever think that you would be in El Salvador? Did you ever think when you began your studies that this is where you would end up?
I didn't. Although on my first visit, I'm surprised as I look back. I remember visiting the UCA for the first time in 1984 and saying to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be wonderful to teach here? And I must say, it's a rare day that goes by that I don't thank God for having the privilege to teach theology in this context where we have almost 200 theology students from mostly Latin America, and where I'm also able to serve as a bit of a bridge between North and South and contribute to the formation of the globalization of solidarity that John Paul II talked about.
Thanks there to Jesuit Father Dean Brackley, Professor of Theology and Ethics at the University of Central America in El Salvador. He was talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane.
And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me, Philippa Hitchin. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.